I'm my co-host, John Turpin. John, who are you? I know you're under the weather.
Yeah, and what weather it is.
yeah, it's pretty crummy.
We have, like, slush or stew for some reason. It's pretty interesting. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's the food or something of that nature. It's been awful. I felt horrid this whole week. I've got ham and pea soup in the crock pot right now that I'm just staring at, wanting to fast forward the timer so that I can eat that. So that's what I'm looking forward to this evening. And I apologize for the listeners if the auditory experience, I've got sort of an extra bit of gravel in.
Yes, it is. I was going to say that we've boosted your gravel levels about 10%. Are you on any kind of cold medicine? Can we expect any really fun hot takes from you? Like Daniel Vogelbach will be the starting first baseman.
I think you should just say that anyway
and like just do it under the guise of being on lots of flu medicine.
Yeah, all of my grandiose statements are purely due to the Sudafed PE that I've just been mainlining to try and stay or just functional in any way. But
fantastic.
I may be laying low, I guess is what okay. I'm saying. But that's okay because we have a guest who.
Yeah, why don't you introduce the guest since you came up with the great segue and everything.
Our guest today is Casey Boguslaw. Casey, you are you've been all over the place, but you're now working for Forward Mile MLB. Where else, I guess, can we find you, Casey?
So I did run a website for a couple years called RO Baseball, and did actually stop that endeavor last year, unfortunately. Life got in the way a little bit, and it was just becoming too much of my slate, and I wanted to focus more on just writing and doing the analytics that I often find myself doing while sitting in my cubicle. So I decided to, unfortunately, end that project. But that group of guys is great, and there's still the site is gone, but all those guys are still great writers, and they're all around. But Forward Mile found me a couple months ago and started me writing there and to prepare for the launch, which was last Wednesday, and it's been pretty successful so far.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's more than just MLB too. It's all the sports.
Even like
golf, I believe is on there. I mean, I haven't even checked out everything that's on there yet. Yeah, there's fantasy golf, I guess.
Impossible. Impossible.
That's what I see at least on the things that pop up on my phone now when I get Forward Mile alerts. But there's a team of baseball writers. You know, we're kind of half fantasy. It's a pretty heavy fantasy associated website, but there's this other section of the website that is just going to be writing about everyday baseball and doing analytics. Of course, some of my stuff that I've developed quite a following of fantasy baseball players because they like some of the stuff that I tweet out, and it does help them with fantasy. It helps myself with fantasy, but I won't necessarily be writing solely about DFS strategies or anything like that. I'll be doing more big picture stuff at 4 Mile. So that's about where I am at. My stuff is I'll still blog like a random thing here and there on just my Medium site. So medium.com/Casey Boguslaw.
So some of your fantasy stuff is, even if you're not directly writing about fantasy, you are dealing with a lot of the StatCast data, right? The new level of data that we have, which can be helpful in making objective decisions about one's fantasy teams, right?
Absolutely. Some of my friends would say that I've developed a somewhat obsession with the barrel stat, but I've done a lot of stuff with barrels over the last couple of years since those guys over at MLB Advanced Media came up with the term. Should I explain what a barrel is?
Yeah, let's start. We'll work through each of your like pet projects, your hobby horses.
Sure.
But I think definitely I got to know you while you were using the barrel stat. Like you brought that to my attention. So yeah, let's start there.
So yeah, when StatCast kind of was giving us batted ball data on every single play, which included exit velocity and launch angle, they created the best combination of those two items to find the best batted ball outcome. And where they decided on was the combination that led to at least a 500 batting average on the total population and a 1500 slugging percentage. And so basically it's the best thing that you can do at the plate. It's kind of, you know, it goes against, you know, anything weather-wise, anything stadium-wise. If you hit a batted ball at Coors Field or if you hit a batted ball that are barrels at Safeco, it's the same exact kind of way that the ball is coming off the bat. So it's even across the all playing fields, which is kind of really why I liked it a lot. And I went ahead and with a couple guys helped create the Twitter account at MLB Barrel Alert. And that auto tweets out every single time a barrel is hit real time. It shoots out all of the data that you would want to know about that batted ball. And we've developed quite a following there and had a lot of fun. We were doing it manually for like the first month, which was insane. We just had a Slack chat room and be like, okay, I'll tweet out Aaron Judge's. You guys got the next one.
Did you maybe just have to have one person devoted to Aaron Judge?
Judge. We had one guy that was solely dedicated to just watching Aaron Judge. But a programmer did eventually approach us. It was a couple weeks into the season and said, hey, I could do this for you guys, you know, to do it automatically. And we said, ha, for free? And the guy said, yeah, sure, why not? So it was great.
Blessings to the programmers.
Thank that guy a lot at Canuck. That's all I know him by. It's like one of those crazy, you know, programmer things. But thank God for him. So we didn't have to do that. And then everyone can have it even faster than we were tweeting them out. So that's where I started, and I did a lot of stuff. So then I guess the next step we could go to, if you want, I developed Barrel FIP.
Absolutely.
This is where, so the as far as barrels, I mean, I'm sure Nelson Cruz passed under your nose a fair amount of times for Mariners hitting barrels, maybe not as much as some others, but unfortunately, I feel like Barrel FIP is a time where we pop up. Am I correct in that?
Well, positively or negatively.
The 2017 Mariners, I feel like I spent an awful lot of time looking at charts that you sent out with a lot of Mariner pitcher names in red.
Yes, unfortunately so. So what I did with – this was the previous offseason when I was kind of just looking at barrel charts and, you know, barrels were always on my mind. And this was even, I think, before I came up with the Barrel Alert account. I was reading a lot of stuff about FIP over the offseason for some reason. And I know that, you know, in certain areas of our analytical world, people were frowning on FIP. And, you know, once we were kind of learning more about StatCast, that pitchers do kind of have a little bit more of a control over, you know, what type of batted balls are hit against them. People didn't want FIP to be as basic as it was, which was, you know, just strikeouts, walks, and home runs. And then, like I just explained with what barrels do, since they treat every batted ball fairly, that was a little bit more, I guess, fair than just looking at home runs. Because, obviously, if you're at Coors, you're going to allow more home runs than, you know, anywhere else. So I decided to just kind of simply replace the home run in the FIP calculation with barrels and adjusted the coefficients as such to make that, you know, make a little bit more sense as far as where the linear weights were. And started tweeting out those every day that every starting pitcher that was going to pitch that day, I sent out their barrel FIP data. And that's kind of where I got a lot of my following. And we mentioned before, especially from a fantasy standpoint, people wanted to know for their daily fantasy or what starters to pitch on their team that day. You know, I was posting, you know, their season results and their last 30 days, because those, of course, certainly do fluctuate, you know, as most pitching statistics do. A lot of people really liked it. I got a lot of feedback, and everything, you know, that I've gotten back is people just want more. So I'm hoping to be able to continue giving the people what they want.
That's very kind of you. Have you seen any, with replacing the home runs with the barrel stat, what's the biggest change that you've seen? Which player was the most affected by that? Has this Barrel Fip or Barrels, either of them revealed anything to you that maybe players we wouldn't think of necessarily? What has been revealed to you through these stats?
Two pop off the top of my head, and maybe it's my Chicago roots, but from a pitching standpoint, Jeff Samardzija, you know, who spent time on both areas, both sides of town here, had a really terrible season if you just look at his ERA, and Barrel Fip really liked him all season. And I wrote a pretty lengthy piece, I want to say in like July or August, about what exactly was going on, but he was having some bad luck. But, you know, I was basically saying you kind of do have to believe in Jeff Samardzija going forward because he wasn't allowing hard hit balls. And I think something we will obviously get to at some point in this podcast is the Giants had a terrible outfield behind him, really big outfield, as you guys know, at AT&T. So that has a huge effect on him as well. That's not directly related to Barrels, but I'm kind of getting, you know, ahead of myself here. But, it is all kind of, they all correlate a little bit, that he wasn't getting hit very, very hard. And that's what Barrels showed me. From a hitter standpoint, Kyle Schwarber had a very weird year. A lot of people were very down on him, and I actually was looking at a fantasy page today, and they had Kyle Schwarber outside the top 100 players, which I totally disagree with. You know, if you're in a fantasy draft coming up in the next couple of months, don't wait that long to draft Kyle Schwarber. He can mash the ball. He hits a ton of barrels. He had one of the best barrel percentages. I look at it from a plate appearance standpoint. He also walks a ton too, which is, you know, just good for, you know, actual baseball as well. I think he should be fine. I don't know if batting leadoff screwed with his head or what it was, but I really just think it was a slump, and I think people overreacted because they were the world champions, and it was a big deal. So, you know, the barrel stuff kind of lets you see between the lines there, and you know,
whenever a scout like Zielinski compares you to Babe Ruth, I feel like that you're carrying that, right? Expectations for Schwarber. I didn't know that scouting report existed, except that I had done some different research in looking at other players who were compared to Babe Ruth, and the Schwarber thing popped up, and I was like, oh. So I'd always kind of wondered where that weight of expectations on him came from, or why it seemed like Schwarber was talked about a little bit differently. And, you know, when you invoke Babe Ruth's name, I think you invoke a whole bunch of baggage with that.
Yeah. I mean, think about the path that guy's been on. He had this incredible rookie season and got called up, you know, much earlier than a lot of those guys do. Mm-hmm. Then he misses an entire season due to a devastating injury, but then he comes back in the World Series out of nowhere and has a great couple games when he's out there. And then he had all this pressure, and he was put in the leadoff position right on opening day. I mean, that's huge. You're the leadoff hitter for the world champions. There's going to be pressure. I don't think anyone could really get past that.
So you're predicting maybe some bounce back years for guys who struggled a little last year with Shark and Schwarber. Because this is a Mariners podcast, and because I am a small-minded person, what popped out to you about the Mariners pitchers last year regarding Barrel Fip? Other than Ariel Miranda being in the red pretty much constantly all the time, every time you tweeted out one of those charts.
Yeah, those home runs that he allowed were mostly barrels, so it wasn't like Barrel Fip was really saving him much. He couldn't cheat the system with looking at the home runs that he allowed, just because they were hit always pretty pure off the bat. The one thing I will mention, though, Kate, I think that you are already very encouraged by this guy, but I know that for a pretty good chunk of the season, James Paxton was the best pitcher in Barrel Fip in all of Major League Baseball. Him and Sale were kind of alternating, I know, for a large part of the season as well. Of course, kind of when, obviously, you know, we have to mention the injury, but that took him kind of where I had the minimum inning set. But he still obviously had a very good season, Barrel Fip-wise, you know, even better than his ERA, better than his FIP as well. So, I mean, just a great season all around. Obviously, those big strikeout guys are going to rank high, but he was also not allowing barrels. Only less than 2% of the time was he allowing a barrel.
Oh, that is just, that's a beautiful sentence. Mm-hmm. I understand why people get things tattooed on them suddenly.
You know what?
Smaller than 2% barrel rate. Mm, yes. Stitch that in a sampler.
So, Casey, one of the things, you know, especially with barrel FIP and with all these things, it seems like, it has seemed like through your writing and through the research that you've done, you're someone who likes it when the ball is put in play. Or at least finds baseball more engaging when that is. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. I mean, especially when you put it out like that. You know, of course, strikeouts are exciting, but I think everything else that happens once the ball is put in play, it just kind of, you know, exponentially adds to the fun of the game. Absolutely.
Yeah. And in that vein, you know, one of the things I think that you and I first interacted with, and one of the things that both Kate and I found very engaging was a lot of the research, in addition to what you did with pitchers, was research on the impact of outfield defense and, you know, the sort of value that you can accrue from, I guess, saving runs on line drives and fly balls, and how we saw essentially this year a couple teams, you know, some of the best teams were teams that didn't even have to worry about that because so many baseballs were just flying over the fence. Was that sort of a frustrating, I guess, turn of events? Or how was that to sort of watch things play out?
Yeah, and actually, you know, that's kind of why the Mariners struck my fancy for most of the season. You know, I am a White Sox fan, and so last season it was kind of like, okay, I'm excited for the White Sox rebuild, but I need another team to kind of just, you know, be a fan of while the White Sox go through what they're going through. Obviously, they weren't competing. So it was the Mariners that I attached to just because I was really excited the way that that team was assembled. And
it, yeah, the only bandwagon fan.
Yeah, I know. But no, yeah. I think, you know, the way that DePoto made this team was to get the best outfield possible. And I wrote an article that was at the Hardball Times last offseason that basically was looking at, hey, let's look at the last two teams that won the World Series. It was the Kansas City Royals, who really didn't have much to hang their hat on other than they hit a lot of contact on the ball and they played amazing defense. And then the Cubs played even better defense than they did the following year. So I kind of was looking at who was going to be this team in 2017 that could kind of come out of really, you know, be a pretty even team, you know, okay pitching, okay hitting, but are really carried by an excellent offense or excellent defense. And I thought Seattle could certainly be in that pack. But then what we saw, you guys mentioned, I don't know if the ball was necessarily the reason that the Mariners were allowing a lot of home runs.
They didn't need a lot of help. That's what I'll say.
How many pitchers were used? You know, how many 17. You guys?
Starters. So that was just starters. Was it 48 pitchers? 48 pitchers? Yeah,
whatever it was, is a record, I know. Yeah. And I know DePoto on his podcast was saying that he was just going through 40-man roster moves because he just had to bring up an arm to use. And, of course, these guys aren't going to be strikeout pitchers. They're going to be putting the ball into play, and a lot of the times the balls were going to be leaving.
And out of play.
Right. So, you know, a defense can only be it can only be as great as it you know, is allowed to be if the ball is actually available to catch. So, but you know, these numbers that I've been putting together that I've written a couple articles here in the last week or so, the Mariners had a great defense. And they did more impact than you guys would probably even think about it because, you know, the focus was on the home runs. And of course, you know, everything else that went, you know, pointing in the down direction for the Mariners. But they still did have a really excellent defense. That part of DePoto's plan certainly worked. But no one can predict that many injuries. I think if they do have some health, you know, I know that the outfield's a little bit different. I'm sure we'll get into that. But, you know, they still do have a lot of good parts to put out there.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the next metric that you are really excited about or are working on developing, which I think you call catch probability. Is that right?
So
or catch percentage?
Catch percentage. Probability? So StatCast does have a catch probability metric, and that's why I didn't want to
step
on their toes, sorry. Even though I step on their toes a lot with barrels. But and percentage is because I'm really kind of making this statistic pretty basic as far as I'm looking at a population of batted balls, and I just kind of limited it to line drives and fly balls, which are defined by Baseball Savant using launch angle and exit velocity. And so I can kind of easily bucket them, and I'm only looking at balls in play, and I'm basically saying, did this outfield catch it and did it not? And that's as easy as it is. I'm not going into range factors. I'm definitely not looking at arms or anything like that, the arm strength of the outfielders. I'm just kind of looking at which outfield caught the most balls, you know, that were available to be caught. And another thing on top of that is this has kind of always been a little bit of a pet peeve of mine, but and it's kind of a theory that I have is that I really think the entire outfield unit is what makes for the best outfield. One thing, I don't know why I keep talking about the Cubs, especially as a White Sox fan. My White Sox fan friends are going to yell at me. But, you know, Dexter Fowler didn't have great metrics in that World Series year, but they had such a good outfield defense that it just kind of made sense as a unit, and I think that the fact that he had Jason Hayward next to him certainly would probably have some impact on the amount of balls that he has to get to. He knows that he doesn't have to cover that, you know, whatever, that segment of right field because Jason Hayward's going to get to it, and that's going to have an impact. So that's just an example of what I think that an outfield unit can have, that those guys that are playing next to you are going to affect your ability of what you have to do. If you have a bad outfielder to your, you know, to on your one side, you're going to have to shadow a little bit that way. So I broke these down by units as well. That was just something that I wanted to make sure that if I was to create some sort of metric that looked at outfield defense, I wanted to break it down by who were the three guys out in the field at the time.
And do you separate that then? So a lot of teams have obviously a fourth outfielder that they sub in. You have changes made all the time. You don't know, you're not always running the same three guys out there, right? How is that accounted for in your stat?
So I have every single unit that was ever put on,
like including, you know, the ones that use Nelson Cruz in the outfield.
Yep.
You have that.
If a guy was thrown out there for one play, I have that in my data right now. Just, you know, at a fluke, if they had to put a pitcher out in the outfield, you know, that then that is showing up in my data. I have everyone's name out in here.
And for one of the things that I, you know, noticed and found interesting was that Cleveland last year did, you know, the sort of unexpected move of putting Jason Kipnis in center field, which, you know, I think he was an outfielder coming up, if I'm not mistaken, or at least did a little bit of both. Yeah. But hadn't played in a long time, but they flanked him with two sort of plus, or at least, you know, regarded as plus defenders with Austin Jackson and then Abraham Almonte and occasionally Jose Ramirez, which is certainly something that we're interested in now as Mariners fans watching D. Gordon, a different second baseman with inarguably better athleticism than Jason Kipnis, sort of make that transition as well.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a little bit of apples and oranges. I know that that's what all Mariners fans are hoping. I do think that. So the thing that I wanted to address with Kipnis. So what was funny about this, and I, like I mentioned, the Hardball Times article that I wrote, that it was so focusing on you need outfield defense to win a championship. It is your X factor. And then the Houston Astros go and win the World Series. And by these numbers that I'm running, that I just wrote an article about, they were the absolute worst outfield in the league last year. And the Indians were very low as well. The Indians were the team that I picked to win the World Series last year. So, and of course they had the best. They had the best record in the league, right? In the American League.
Yeah, definitely in the American.
Yeah. So, you know, so what I did, kind of course, my, you know, I had to ask myself, what in the world did I miss here? And I think that my explanation for that is, if you have a pitching staff that is going to not allow many balls hit the outfield, then you don't necessarily need a great outfield.
Yeah.
And what the Astros are doing is absolutely ridiculous. You know, bringing in Gerrit Cole, now they have another guy that's 20% plus strikeout guy, as far as, you know, per plate appearance. Mm-hmm. They're just not letting balls get hit out there. And of course they have a bunch of ground ball guys. Of course, Keuchel is a huge ground ball guy. Mm-hmm. We can see their strategy is strikeout, ground ball guy, let's put a bunch of offensive guys, you know, offense heavy guys in the outfield, and we don't necessarily have to worry about defense because our pitching staff's not going to allow that many balls out there. And that was kind of, I think Francona actually said this directly when he wanted to put Kipnis in center field was, look, not a lot of balls go out there in center field. Right. What does he have to do? Yeah. So
it's the little league strategy of outfield to get your good hitter in.
So now we're seeing kind of the comparison here. You know, the Astros and Indians that have a bunch of strikeout guys, they don't necessarily have to. And I'm not even saying – I think they do have, you know, fourth outfielders that are probably a little bit more defense metric-minded. And even the Astros had Jake Marisnyk, who got hurt and was out for the entire postseason, who is a very good defender. So I think that, of course, obviously affected the numbers a lot. But when the Astros do have to make their decision of setting their lineup every day, maybe you don't put in Jake Marisnyk. You do put in three offense guys in the outfield because Justin Verlander's pitching, and he's going to strike out 12 guys. Whereas the Mariners, you know, they don't have the, you know, strikeout heavy guys outside of Paxton. So you do want to make sure that you do have the right outfield out there that's going to have to be running around a lot to be tracking down these fly balls.
You have some words of comfort for Mariners fans regarding Cole, though, right? After that trade was made. Pretty much everyone regarded that as a huge coup for the Astros, especially considering what they gave up. They did not have to part with any of their top prospects. But you see, perhaps maybe going back to your barrel stat, maybe not the best fit for that teeny tiny ballpark.
So just as we addressed in the Mariners, you can't catch the ball if it's hit out of the park. And Garrett Cole had 31 home runs last season in Pittsburgh, which is pretty spacious. Minute Maid is not spacious at all. It's very tiny. I think I counted, I tweeted out a graphic of all of the home runs Garrett Cole allowed and overlaid it on Minute Maid Park. I think it was every fly ball allowed. And there were about seven fly balls that would have left Minute Maid that didn't leave PNC. Well, they didn't leave whatever park he was in, whether it was PNC or, you know, a road park. So if he allowed those hits at Minute Maid, those would have been more home runs, and he would have been pushing 40. And so, I mean, of course, there's a lot of other people that are reasoning that the Astros pitching staff is going to help Garrett Cole and have him pitching more breaking balls because that's what the Astros did a lot last season, and that should help Garrett Cole. But if he were to have the same season that he had in 2017, next season with the Astros, I don't think the Astros are going to be very happy, but he's probably only going to be their number four, number five pitcher, maybe. I mean, it's ridiculous the amount of depth they have. And that's not even clowning Brad Peacock and Colin McHugh, who are, again, strikeout, non-fly ball guys. That's what the Astros just have so much strength in. And a point that I mentioned in the article is that these guys don't grow on trees. These are the tough guys to find. You know, the guys that the Astros have hoarded all of them. I think I wrote that there were like 72 pitchers, I want to say, that were like over 21%, which was about was the average strikeout rate. The Astros have six, I think. So if you're saying 72, that's about two a team, and the Astros have six just on their team alone, and that's just starting pitchers. I mean, that's ridiculous, and obviously there's not enough to go around.
Yeah.
We have none.
We got packs.
We got some questions, so to flip back to outfield defense for a little bit. Defensive metrics, you know, definitely something that I think are under fire a little when we talk about the advanced stats, and we did get a question from one of our staff writers, Isabel Manassian, about kind of the difficulty in assessing outfield stats. Are there any that you, or defensive metrics, are there any defensive metrics that you think are particularly good / particularly unreliable? What do you look at, and what kind of went into your decision to not look at things like range when you were just pure whether the ball was caught or not?
Right. So, I mean, the ones that we had for a long time, and a long time now is, what, a decade, is, you know, UZR and DRS. You know, they're both fine, and I will glance at them, all the time when I'm looking at players and I wanted to see something. I think that those both of those metrics are very player oriented. You know, you can of course pull it up on Fangraphs, but per team, but I don't think that that's what the metric was created for. They do want to just look at the individual, but when you're looking at just the individual, those stats were made, they didn't have the starting position for those outfielders, so it's kind of based off of where a normal outfielder would be starting, you know, which is, I think, probably just straight away, you know. And
so
then they're looking at
how consideration the shift that
no
the
no
outfield
not at
shift
all
in the age of shifting. Okay,
yeah. And then, you know, DRS really, you know, has a large part impacted by the outfielder's arm, which of course is a big part of being an outfielder. I just, you know, the stuff that I've been looking at is just catching the ball. The arm, having an arm is great, and it's a plus, you know, and it certainly does have an impact on, you know, keeping a runner from advancing that extra base. It's just really hard to judge based on the data that we have right now. So, but with that, what I wanted to mention is that StatCast is doing things all the time, and they're going to come out with more and more stuff. They came out with two pretty cool defensive metrics last season in catch probability, which was the 1 through 5 stars, which is cool, and we could kind of see, you know, how often that specific catch is made. If it's only made 10% of the time, then that's obviously an exceptional catch. And then they did outs above average, which kind of just extrapolates that into how many outs each outfielder saved. You know, there's stuff that I think people might just accept that is including, that I know that is not all the way there, which includes, you know, wall balls. You know, if an outfielder is running up next to a wall, that's going to influence their range factor. It's going to give, you know, make it a detriment. You know, Andrew Benintendi had really poor statistics as far as these two StatCast metrics that I mentioned, but he's playing in front of
the
Green Monster.
Green Monster, yeah. Oh.
So, you know, if a ball is technically in his range, quote unquote, and there's a giant wall behind him, it's obviously a lot more difficult to make. And so, you know, one of the things that I did with this catch percentage stuff is I looked at home versus road, and I can see that I can just separate what Andrew Benintendi did on the road and see what his true measurements are, taking away that Green Monster. That's another thing. You know, the two stats are great, like I mentioned, on StatCast, but you can't break them down in any way. As far as home, road, you know, even by month, you know, stuff like that. And the one thing that I'm going to drill again is you can't look at who was playing next to him, which I do think has such strong importance. And, you know, none of those statistics, UZR, DRS, none of them address who is the entire outfield unit. You can't break it down by that anywhere. So I figured, why not me?
Well, talk to us a little bit about, as you were doing that outfield unit work, I believe the Mariners showed up pretty well in that. So talk to us a little bit about what you think is... So that's the trio of Gamble, Dyson, Haniger?
No, Heredia, Dyson.
Heredia. Gamble, Heredia.
Heredia, Dyson, and Gamble.
Okay. Yeah. Heredia, Dyson, Gamble. What? How did they come out in your rankings, and what do the numbers tell you?
Yeah, the first article I wrote was just the basics. Basically, how many times was a ball hit to the outfield, and how many times was it caught? And I looked at minimum 200 chances, which again is 200 balls hit out to them. And that trio that you mentioned, and I, of course, I think I DM'd you immediately when I found this because I knew it would excite you, Kate.
They
were 65%. So, you know, 2 out of every 3 balls are caught by that unit. And I know that unit is probably going to be no more, so it probably doesn't mean anything to people moving forward. But maybe D can fit in, you know, seamlessly for Jared. I don't know. But... other things that popped out, I know I mentioned in the first article, like, and this, of course, hits home for you guys in your division, was the Mike Trout numbers were interesting as far as, it, units that replaced Trout, especially because obviously he missed a bunch of time last year, did better without Trout. I don't know if that means more about Trout or more about Cameron Maybin, who is sitting on the free agency right now without a job, which I find kind of interesting because someone could probably get him very cheaply.
And was waived last year. Like that, the whole treatment of Cameron Maybin last year was bizarre to me.
Yes. I can't believe the Astros got him for free, especially because I mentioned the Mariznick injury. That was exactly what they needed last year.
Yeah. It
was an outfield fourth outfielder. That was bizarre. Absolutely.
I can't believe right the Giants didn't jump on him this offseason and put him in their outfield, because wouldn't he be a huge boon to them?
Maybe it can still happen. I totally agree, Kate. I think Jared Dyson or Cameron Maybin would fit perfectly, and especially because they've already said McCutcheon's okay with playing a corner outfield.
Who had the worst outfield unit? Who was really kind of low on the...
It was the Giants. Giants trio I mentioned about Smarja. This is what I'm talking about. Jarrett Parker, Denard Span, and Hunter Pence was 50. I had the wrong one. Austin Slater, Denard Span, and Hunter Pence were 52%.
And the Mariners were the leaders at 65%.
MLB average was 57. So.
Wow.
Yeah, and those are two, like, fairly comparable in terms of spaciousness outfields, usually, right? Like, or I know the Giants have weirder angles, for sure. But in terms of sort of run suppression, at least prior to last year, or prior to the last couple of years, maybe.
So here's what I got for you, John. You know, I started kind of crunching numbers even further and trying to see like how far I can push this data and what I can get out of it. But what I created a park factor metric based off of this data. So just looking at how road teams fared at, you know, whatever stadium, for example, at Safeco, road teams caught 60% of balls, of these balls. So,
okay.
And Giants, AT&T was 56%. Coors is the worst, 50%. And that's because Coors is so big.
Yeah.
Road teams only caught, 50%. So it was a coin flip, basically, if you're going to catch that ball or not.
That's crazy. I know, Casey, we talked a little bit, too, about another factor at Safeco, which is its ability to deaden extra base hits. Specifically, its ability to suppress triples. Did we talk about this? I feel like
I tweeted you guys out that it was Coors that allowed the most runners to score from first on a double. What I think was the metric that I pulled, and Safeco was the lowest percentage of that. Now that's. Of course, I think it's going to be, you know, influenced by the Mariners' outfield. And again, they get to balls quickly, so they're going to prevent runners from scoring from first on a double the most. But I think that there is a park factor indeed as well, because I think that's why we see on the flip end what Coors does in the reverse way.
And related to that, we also talked about the flip side of that with runners who take the extra base or who are able to maybe stretch a double. What did you call that one again?
So I wrote an article maybe a month or two ago about, I call it risk versus reward.
Risk versus reward, that's right.
And I had this cool little chart that plotted every team in their risk versus reward. And how I defined those were, the risk segment was how often the team got thrown out on the bases, which I love to always call two plans, thrown out on the bases like a complete, like a nincompoop.
There we go.
And, but then the reward was how often teams go from first to third on a single or score from second on a single. That was the two areas that I looked at. And so I basically said that if you are in, you know, a high risk, high reward. If you are a high risk, high reward team, at least you're getting something out of it. You're obviously really aggressive on the bases. Boston Red Sox, I know that I heard all throughout the season on my Twitter feed from Boston Red Sox fans that they were so sick of their players getting thrown out on the bases. But they got such a great reward, though, out of, you know, they were running from, they were going from first to third more often than any other team. They were scoring from second and single more than any other team. So clearly the team strategy on the base pass was to just be as aggressive as possible. We'll take the outs because we're going to overcome that with how many bases, how many extra bases we're getting.
Mm. You have to have a certain kind of team for that too, right? Like the Mariners with their crew of plotters are not going to be well served to take on that kind of a strategy.
I know that that's something we talked about. That, yeah, because, you know, you're going to have a Nelson Cruz in front of you on the base paths. You're not going to be able to often get that extra base and, you know, other guys in the team. Yeah, the, obviously, if you're comparing the athleticism with especially the 2017 version of the Boston Red Sox, I think, yeah, you know, even them taking Ortiz out of the lineup, they knew that they had to do something else, you know, and that's kind of where they made up for the loss of power on that team.
Who is the best on the Mariners at taking the extra base? Who is our, so getting back to that risk reward, let's talk about where the Mariners fell on that quadrant. Did we explain all the parts of the quadrant? We should probably explain the rest of the quadrant so people who haven't read it can kind of picture it.
Yeah, so low risk, low reward would mean that you're not getting thrown on the bases, but you're not really often advancing that extra base. So I would not necessarily say that's a positive or a negative. If you are getting thrown out a lot on the bases and you are not advancing a base very often, that's the worst place you can be.
Who hangs out around there? Who's hanging out at that?
So the Tigers, the Phillies, the Yankees.
The Yankees
surprisingly were not a great team on the base pass. That one kind of surprised me a little bit.
Well, they don't have – they've got – I mean, Judge is not super fast.
He's athletic, though. You know, you look at, like, somebody like Chris Bryan, who's, you know, really, really tall guy, but he's a great base runner. He really uses his athleticism.
I don't know. I'm probably just stereotyping Judge based on – and, you know, the man doesn't often have to race around the bases because – he's doing a trot or he's walking back to the dugout after striking out. He did walk a lot though, so especially there towards the end, that would be interesting to look at. Sanchez, I guess Sanchez is not very fast, and then they had some old guys too, so I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, Chase Headley and guys like that, you know, Frazier? Even to Todd Frazier for a while. The Mariners were fairly neutral. They were a little bit in that bottom right section, the bad section. I think it's because they have some good and some bad. And I think that's kind of just where it kind of comes out in the wash. The other section, though, is low risk, high reward. That's the best place you can be. So low risk, high reward is you're not getting thrown on the bases and you're often taking the extra base. The Arizona Diamondbacks were the best team by far in this metric. Yeah. You know, they got a very athletic outfield, AJ Pollock, David Peralta. I mean, Paul Goldschmidt is an excellent base runner. You think of him as this power hitter, this average hitter, but he is a fantastic base runner as well, especially for first baseman. And then the Dodgers as well. Dodgers have athletic catchers as well. That's a big thing. And a pretty athletic team. You don't see a lot of plotters on that team, especially they didn't have Adrian Gonzalez last year. Chase Utley played sparingly. So the Diamondbacks and the Dodgers, those were the two best base running teams according to my study here.
Interesting.
Well, the Mariners were pretty poor on the base paths last year. I think anyone will tell you that, and that in the off-season conversations has been a point of emphasis. Service has talked about, DePoto has talked about, we have to get better on the base paths, which is tough because they only have so much of a ceiling. You know, Seager is never going to be fast. Cruz, Cano, Zunino is slow. You know, you've got a lot. Healy is very slow. All that speed is going to have to come from the outfield and Segura, essentially. Who runs well on the Mariners, according to the research that you did?
So Mitch Haniger was the guy to kind of jump off the page here. He only got thrown on the bases 3 times last season. You know, obviously very, very good. He went from first to third 7 of 18 opportunities. which is 39%. Average was about 29%.
Oh, wow.
And he scored from second on a single 9 out of 17 times, about 53%. That's a little bit below average, but the first to third was what he does very, very good. Another guy that does first to third very well was Ben Gamel, 14 of 28 times. 50%, and I mentioned the average was 29%. So,
wow,
really good. But Ben Gamel got thrown out of the bases 10 times. So that's yes. The high risk, high reward segment that I'm talking about, though. That Boston Red Sox segment. That yeah, you're going to be aggressive. You kind of want to obviously see the outs on the bases get put down a little bit. But clearly he's being aggressive.
That's so interesting, though. I would not have thought of Haniger as one of our better base runners off the top of my head. So.
I have a curiosity, and it does not need an answer right now, but just as we've talked about, like, you're limited when you're running behind, like, if you're hitting behind Cruz or Cano, they were a group of dudes that had a lot of loud singles, and I can't help but wonder if Haniger, who hit second for a lot of the year, was maybe the beneficiary of a lot of line drives into the gap by Cano or Cruz, who saw the ball going and said, yeah. I think one base is enough for me on this one. But that is very interesting because as Kate said, and it's been funny to look, especially I remember when when the sprint speed numbers sort of came out, it was very exciting and interesting to look at and see like. Oh, Taylor Motter is this, has the same average sprint speed as Kyle Seager, but Taylor Motter is, stealing 10, 15 bases. Kyle Seager goes to bed at night dreaming of his, one stolen base a year that he gets. He plans for it every year. So I guess finding these little ways because, and that's, I guess, what I think. I find very interesting about the stuff you do, Casey, is that, we're pretty good at measuring offensive production. I think it's fair to say whether, there's a lot that we can refine and definitely, seeing who maybe is getting unlucky, but it's still, there's still so much nuance and uncertainty about what really is good defensive production and what is good base running these types of things, I think, are really interesting, and it's fun to see. It was neat to see someone, I guess, just taking these numbers and saying, "Well, I'm going to make a metric out of this." Seeing the sort of pop up, the ways that new analytics and new ways of measurement can pop up has been a really neat thing, and.
I like everything you do, Casey, obviously.
And I actually, I have a funny anecdote here. The reason kind of why I have done this, why I want to learn more about outfield defense and measure it and base running and stuff, is because Robin Ventura destroyed, my love of baseball for quite a long period of time when he managed this team at least it made me want to learn why the White Sox were so bad. Because I just watched them, and I'm like, that outfield is horrible at what they're doing. And they got in these base running mistakes that, it just seems like, I know this isn't 100% true, but it feels like outfield defense and, all defense, including infield and base running, are things that can be coached, that you can get a lot out of. These guys are all athletes. I know we talked about, Nelson Cruz is a big guy and everything, and doesn't have great foot speed, but if you can coach him not to get thrown out on the bases because he's being coached. There's a first base coach. There's a third base coach. The outfield is put in. One thing that I have not mentioned one time throughout this entire podcast is I think that even scouting the opposition and positioning these outfielders is a big portion of, how these metrics can be increased. And that's why I look at it by team. I think that that's such a big deal. Maybe the Mariners don't have to go completely all out on having three sub 200 batting average guys in the outfield, because if they're being coached up and have these, you know, athletic guys, I think that could be a big key to this D. Gordon thing. If it works, is obviously he's a great hitter, and if he is, let's say, 85% of what Jared Dyson was in center field,
mm-hmm.
I think you're making up for that 15% yeah. with just the bat. So mm-hmm. maybe there is that plus minus, and that's got to be something that's on DePoto's mind, that he knows that their coaching staff knows where to put these guys. You know, it's going to be mostly the same rotation as last year. That's going to be they know how these guys pitch. You know, well, I should say if the rotation stays healthy,
yes,
but
big if.
And you know, I think that's so big. Another thing that I am working on that I haven't put into writing yet is, I guess I tweeted a couple times yesterday, but is looking at each individual pitcher and what outfielders that they had behind them and how well they did, and to see if I can find trends, like why is whatever manager, Scott Service, playing this outfield trio behind Felix Hernandez and not behind James Paxton. Mm-hmm. There's got to be a rhyme or reason, and that's kind of my next project that I'm working on with this data.
I'm looking now, because I you know, when I think of the White Sox, I think of Paul Konerko, I think of, you know, Frank Thomas, and I think of, you know, those sort of really strong mid-2000s teams. But you guys did really have a stretch where it was like Adam Dunn and Alex Rios as like the, you know, outfield out there. So I can see how that would be a little bit grim.
Even Avisail Garcia was just
so
bad out there. But last year he was great. What was different? There was a different manager. Now, I'm not saying that it's a 1+1=2 thing here, but there's something there.
Yeah.
He's being coached differently. Absolutely, he's being coached differently. It's a different coach. But is that all the difference in the world? I don't know. I mean, he said he mm-hmm. only ate chicken all offseason, so maybe that's it. But, you know, but I do think that there is something to how teams are managed, especially in these areas that I've been looking at.
Yeah. I will always remember my image of, oh, this is not the same Mariners defense it used to, or outfield defense it used to be, was Robinson Cano early in the 2016 season, I think it was, just casually ranging back trying to catch a ball that was in shallow right field that I was used to watching Robinson Cano catch that ball because Seth Smith wasn't running in to catch that ball. And all of a sudden he looked behind him and I forget who was playing right field.
Could have been Haniger or...
Well, this was 2016.
I guess already.
I think in 2016, yeah. Because I think by 2017, Cano had learned he didn't have to go into shallow right field anymore and make the catch. Like, it takes so much stress. And that's why I think what I'm really interested in the work that you do is looking at things as a unit, not just looking at the player by himself, but how each of the players who are on the field interact with and affect each other.
Yeah, so I'm hoping I can do it throughout the season, you know, in real time and kind of spot these trends as we go in 2018. That's kind of where I want to go with this.
Fantastic. Well, if you don't follow Casey on Twitter, you definitely should. Casey, give the people your Twitter handle.
At Casey Boguslaw.
pretty basic, pretty easy. Boguslaw, spelled like it sounds. I tried out a lot of exotic pronunciations. None of them were right. Boguslaw. Well, maybe could we answer a few questions before? Can we keep you for a couple minutes?
Absolutely.
Ask a few questions. Because I did call for questions. We got a fair number about Chicago. Not all of them that I understand.
Some weird ones, yeah.
Yeah, so that's Sweezo. We'll skip that one. But but I do feel like our friend Peter at HD Robot just came right at you with why is Chicago deep dish pizza so bad? Ouch. I mean, I agree, and he's right, but ouch.
Oh, this is probably going to get me kicked out of the city, but I'm not a huge deep dish fan.
That's fine. That's as it should be.
I would prefer, you know, crust. It's mm-hmm. fine, and once in a while, we get Giordano's quite a bit at the Boguslaw household, and we do go for a deep dish, you know, stuffed sausage and spinach, and it's very, very good. But I like my pizza kind of on the go. You know, deep dish, you kind of got to go the fork and knife, and it's kind of this whole meal thing. So, I like my pizza with a beer in the other hand, and that's how, yeah.
Like any good American. Correct
you're
answer.
You're both breaking my heart. My my mom's whole family is from Barrington, Illinois, and they'll once a year order Giordano's to be, like, shipped out here, and it's sort of a big to-do, and
Nope.
Giordano's
that's fine.
Good.
No accounting for taste.
All right. The next one comes from Anthony Davis at Jolly Red Giant 93, and Anthony wants, this is a good one for you, Casey, Anthony wants to know, who will make the playoffs more in the next 7 years, the White Sox or the Cubs?
In the next seven years.
Yeah.
Oh, that is a good question.
I've been thinking about it since he asked it, and I'm not sure I have a good answer.
I gotta stick. I've talked way too much about the Cubs this podcast. I'm going with the White Sox. I like everything about their rebuild. I know you guys probably don't follow all of the Lewis Robert updates.
Oh yes, how his last name is pronounced.
I have no idea.
Do you know nothing about me? Like. Obviously, where name pronunciation Twitter is my home.
It's so up in the air how to pronounce his name.
No, it's not. It's Robert. They asked his dad.
I listened to the White Sox podcast today, which is by the NBC Sports guys, and they had a Nicky Delmonico on, and they're at this hitters camp right now in Arizona. All of the like the young guys, the young hitters are down in Arizona, and they asked him how to pronounce his teammate's name, and he said, "I still don't know." So, there is that.
I mean, it's a slow off season. I feel like we need a little bit of a controversy. So, I was disappointed when I saw the definitive answer, and we can't continue to trawl through this because Lord knows there's nothing else going on.
But back to the battle against the Cubs, I really feel like the window is closing at least slowly on the Cubs. Maybe they get Bryce Harper and totally shut me up. But the pitching is the problem over there, and maybe they get Yu Darvish and shut me up. But I feel like the White Sox could be making the playoffs in 2019. And if they follow the blueprint, what I love about – you guys are not going to like me saying this – what the Astros are doing is – they just kind of it doesn't look like their window's ever going to close because they just have loads and loads of depth in the minor leagues, and I think that's the real trick. You know, I don't think the Cubs have done that as much because they move so many of their top prospects to supplant, you know, the big league talent. The Astros haven't had to do that yet, and it just looks like this never-ending train of success, and I hope that's what Rick Hahn is watching and he wants to do with the White Sox. So I hope they make the playoffs the next 6 out of 7 years, hopefully.
One thing I will say is I think the Astros system is they have their few top prospects left, but other than that, they have a lot of guys who are interesting, but not necessarily super highly regarded. I'm not totally sold on the Astros system going forward. And I feel similarly about the Cubs. That's why I too would come down, I think, on the side of believing in the White Sox, because they have just stocked that farm up with on both sides of the ball too. You know, you have Kopech and who else am I thinking of? Jimenez?
Eloy Jimenez is the outfielder,
I mean, that's that. There's some scare, and so just supplant that with some good drafting. And you know, the other thing is the Astros had an opportunity to draft in a way that you can't. I don't think what the Astros did is repeatable anymore. Beyond the years and years and tanking, right? You just don't have the same access to all the draft picks that they had. So this is the story that I tell myself at night when I try to think about a potential path to the Mariners ever having a shot at the AL West.
The White Sox situation was so weird, just because they traded these incredible guys at their peak with great contracts that they were always going to bring in huge packages for those guys, but you don't see it very often because how would you? It's so weird that they were such stars and scrubs, and There's still a lot of debate in White Sox fandom on whether they should have just kept that core and paid for free agents to help supplant it, which certainly could have worked. They decided to go the other way, but I don't think a lot of teams would do that, so I don't know if that's very repeatable.
And, of course, the Cubs have traded Daniel Vogelbach off of their out of their system, which is a killing blow to them. We got a question from David asking, is it time to trade him? John, I'll let you handle that.
A question from who?
David at 509 Fitted wants to know if we should trade Daniel Vogelbach for pitching.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant trade him. Sorry. I was like, well, I don't know. Mean, what's his potential return?
I think that's about the return we could get for Vogelbach at this point, unfortunately. Yeah.
I think you probably have to trade him, if only because there's, you know, Mike Ford or Ryan Healy are going to, you know, command an opening day spot. The Mariners don't get to keep Mike Ford if they don't put him on the 25-man or work out some kind of a deal with
the Yankees, which I think
that's
might,
true.
But
Mitch, yeah. Yeah, and if they do that, then, you know, maybe. But even then, it's especially, you know, you have three guys, two of whom are left-handed hitting, first base only, great plate discipline, not a lot of versatility, haven't quite shown the, you know, translated raw power into game power guys. Like, Mike Ford is essentially a lower pedigree, higher production Daniel Vogelbach, you know, so...
Yeah, at this point, I think it's just a for the player's own good.
I think they move him maybe along with something else in a future deal at some point.
All right, next question. To get back to outfield defense a little, Tim McPhail at Tim Digs It wants to know how long we think the D. Gordon experience will last. So, Casey, kind of given what you have looked at with outfielder range and units, and maybe even hearkening back to the idea of the Kipnis experiment, where you can, if you flank a guy with strong defenders, what's your gut feeling, or what's your prediction on how D. Gordon translates to an outfielder?
It's bold, but I think maybe what could happen, I think at the worst maybe, is that what I mentioned about Dexter Fowler and the 2016 Cubs, that he was just helped out by the two guys on both of his sides. And maybe that can maybe, you know, they're still going to have two out of three outfielders that are very, very good at outfield deep, probably regardless of what happens next season. And if D. Gordon is only average, I think that they can lift him up to above average. But the athletic ability is certainly there. I think DePoto definitely knows what he's doing, and I think that he knows that the risk that he was taking was certainly measured to some degree, and I think that, you know, we might be seeing this a little bit more. Maybe this is going to start a trend that we're going to take these athletic young infielders that come up, you know, Tim Anderson, for example, in the White Sox, you know, if they moved him into the center field because he is so athletic, maybe that is something that we're going to start to see. Ozzie Albies on the Atlanta Braves, who's a second baseman right now, I know was one of the fastest guys on sprint speed, which John mentioned before. Maybe the Braves decide to move him to the outfield after seeing what the Mariners are doing with D. Gordon. If this works, it could really affect baseball, and I think that it could work.
Especially with the expansion of bullpens, you know, you need to find versatility anywhere you can. So, I think we've seen in the last few title teams, you know, those teams have had versatile units, versatile players.
They've had a Marwin Gonzalez. They've had a Ben Sobrist.
Chris Taylor.
Yeah. We know him.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
We didn't. That must be nice.
No, but yeah, but that's, you know, I think that's a good point about the way that could become a trend. I think that would be very fun to see.
One more question from James Roberts at Junk Ball Pitchin'. So with Dr. Lorena Martin now part of the organization and the goal of trying to maintain health, should the Mariners be looking at a permanent six-man rotation? Is there any reason to believe that would help our chances? So maybe given if that six-man rotation includes Ariel Miranda and his extremely red barrel flip, maybe that won't help as much. But what are your thoughts on the and not just the Mariners, but maybe across baseball? We're looking at, obviously, the Angels are going to have to do that to make room for Ohtani. So we're just bringing up all the fun stuff.
Yeah, this is just a sad podcast.
Welcome to Look How
Lit. They're all sad podcasts, Casey.
I'm mostly against six-man rotations. What I would prefer a team to do, especially my Chicago White Sox, are going to have hopefully this vast amount of starting pitching in a couple years here, is use that guy as the first guy out of the bullpen, the long relief guy, and, you know, save your starting pitcher if he does get into a situation that is precarious. I'd much rather my, pitching staff be situated that way. Take one of those guys that can maybe is a little bit better at pitching out of the stretch, and somebody that you'd probably want to pitch only a couple innings so he can maybe up that fastball a couple miles per hour, and just do it that way. I'd rather that way. And how are the Mariners going to have a six-man rotation? They can't keep five pitchers healthy.
Well, what they've talked about, first of all, correct. It is a good question. I think one of their points has been that Felix Hernandez in particular has had so many physical issues that he's going to need extra days off, and just because they travel so often that and have such a much greater travel schedule than any other team in baseball, that the extra rest, even if it's putting in a inferior pitcher talent wise might be beneficial, just to get a little bit of extra rest. I like that they're being creative. I doubt that we see it I think if they had gotten Ohtani, then that's a different, situation. But as it is, I would like to see them be creative in their pitcher usage. And, we've talked a lot about things the Astros are doing on this podcast, but one of the things that we've seen is the Astros have worked a lot of sort of tandem starts in their minor leagues, and essentially getting, maximizing the effort and the production that you're getting from maybe a lesser talent. The Mariners have a lot of fifth or sixth starters, talent-wise. But, if you have a guy like Max Posey or Marco Gonzalez, who first four innings usually is fine and really hits a huge wall that third time through the order. Erasmo Ramirez is a similar kind of guy usually. I think there's beneficial, you can get more benefit, I guess, out of just having a lot of guys with greater stamina who can help maximize those five starts than you would out of six. But that I think there's still creativity worth working with.
All right. Well, Casey, it has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on with us. And why don't we put in one more pitch for where people can find your work, how they can read your work, and where they can follow you on all the various social channels.
Sure. ForwardMile.com is where I'm going to be posting all of the majority of my stuff. You can find me on Medium at Casey Bogoslaw, and you can find me on Twitter at Casey Bogoslaw as well. So, and follow at MLB Barrel Alert as well for instant barrel updates when the 2018 season begins.
Which will not run by an intern frantically watching all of Aaron Judge's at bats anymore.
All automated. We just sit back and watch the profits.
Yeah, like all sports writing.
Step five. Wow, you have to explain it. You made it to step three profit to me off air. All right, thanks again, Casey. Thank you for those of you who sent in questions, and we will talk to you guys next week.